At the outset, ladies and gentlemen, if I could please request that you turn off your cell phones and pagers so that we can all enjoy the Shira without commercial interruption. Okay, can I have your attention, please, everyone? Good morning, and thank you for joining us for today's Yom Iyun, jointly sponsored by Stern Hebrew High School and Chelkenu, a program of Yeshiva University Center for the Jewish Future. It is axiomatic that we as Orthodox Jews are committed to a life of halachic observance. What we say and under what circumstances we may say it is often a halachic issue. The Medrash on last week's Parsha quotes a pasuk from Tehillim and expounds it. Ashrei ha-gever asher sham Hashem mivtacho v'lo fana el rahavim v'shatei chazov. Happy is the man that has made God his trust and has not turned to the arrogant nor to those who fall away treacherously. The Medrash explains, happy is the man that has made God his trust, alludes to our ancestor Yosef, and has not turned to the arrogant nor to those who fall away treacherously. Because Yosef said to the chief butler, but have me in remembrance and make mention of me, 2 years were added to his sufferings and he remained in jail for that additional time. This Medrash certainly appears to be contradictory, since it begins with praise of Yosef as one who trusts in God, but concludes with criticism of Yosef's lack of trust in God. A number of solutions to this question have been offered, and they all revolve around the extra degree of trust in God warranted in the unique circumstances that Yosef found himself in this particular occasion. Clearly, though, our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam should affect our every thought, speech, and deed. Misira, reporting on a fellow Jew to the authorities, is a complex halachic issue, one that I would add, sadly, has become an increasingly practical halachic issue these days. Our guest speaker will address this very issue today. Now, the Yitzchak Breidowitz is an accomplished Talmud Chacham and scholar. He received smicha from Yeshivas Ner Yisrael, where he is highly regarded. He holds a B.S. with honors from Johns Hopkins University and a J.D. magna cum laude from Harvard Law School. He has lectured extensively in the United States and Israel and has written many articles on medical ethics, business ethics, family law, and halacha. He serves presently as the Rav of the Woodside Synagogue in Silver Spring, Maryland, and professor of law at the University of Maryland. It is my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Breidowitz.
Thank you, Rabbi Wecker. It's a pleasure and an honor to address you today, and I think it says a lot about a community that on a day in which you have a legal holiday, you don't have to go to work, that one takes out the time to study Torah.
You're doing fine.
Am I doing okay?
Okay.
Okay, well, if you can hear me, you know, that's
all right. Can anyone not hear? Yeah, probably better off.
Better off without? Okay. Yeah, so basically, I think it's all to your credit that on a legal vacation, you want to study the Torah, and Yasher Koach, and I'm very, very happy to be a participant in that process. I talk on a lot of topics, and frankly, I don't talk on Mesira that often, but it's interesting that unfortunately, as we have our share of people that are doing wrongdoing, the issue of Mesira becomes ever more prevalent. If you look in the litany of hated characters in Jewish history, one of the most hated and despicable characters in our tradition is the person that is called the Moser or the Malshin. The Moser, the informer, the Malshin, the slanderer, even if it's true, is a person in classical halacha, is defined as a person who turns over the person or the property of a fellow Jew to the non-Jewish authorities. The Shulchan Aruch actually states that there are multiple consequences to the Aveira of Mesira. Of course, we're going to have to talk about what is the Aveira of Mesira. One consequence is that a Moser is legally obligated to pay all of the damages that their Mesira causes. If, for example, I inform on a fellow Jew, and as a result, a fellow Jew loses property or suffers a loss of liberty, under the rule as codified in the Shulchan Aruch, I am legally, I am halachically responsible for all of the damages the person suffered. Now that itself is an unusual rule, because if you've studied Bava Kamma, you know that normally, grama benizak in patra, if I indirectly cause damage to you, but I myself didn't take the hammer and smash your window, I'm normally not liable. And yet, mesira is so severe that even a gorem, even a grama, is fully liable. Moreover, it is treated as a great sin. And a third consequence, so there's the sinfulness aspect, there is the tort liability aspect, and then surprisingly, a moser is halachically classified as a rodef. Now a rodef is a term that means pursuer, and normally the concept of a rodef is that if I'm threatening your life, you or a third party may kill me, and that's based on the premise, Habal lahargacha, he who is coming to kill you, hashkem v'harog lo, go and kill him. Of course, the whole concept of rodef got a lot of bad press with the Rabin assassination, where Yigal Amir made the argument that Rabin was a rodef. But now listen, just because somebody misapplies a concept doesn't mean the concept isn't legitimate. Certainly there is a law of rodef. But you may ask, in what way is a moser a rodef? Now it's one thing if I'm turning somebody in to get killed, maybe I'm a rodef. On the other hand, if I'm just informing him to the taxing authorities or the like, why am I a rodef? So the Tshuvas HaRash, Rabbeinu Asher writes, and you'll see how this will play out in modern applications. Right now I'm just giving you the classical definition, that once the non-Jew gets a hold of a Jew's money, they will take and take and take and take until there's nothing left. And eventually they will kill the person as well in an attempt to find more. And therefore the classical Moser, even if he was only Moser on Inyanim of Mammon, was treated as a person who was threatening the lives of the Jewish community. And as a result, the Moser could be summarily executed preemptively to prevent his Mesira from going on. An amazing thing. And we even have at least anecdotal evidence that well into the 20th century, perhaps even in the present, there were occasional situations of the Jewish community actually killing somebody in order that they should not be a Moser. Now, of course, keep in mind the following idea, that the heter to kill a rodef is to prevent the damage from being done. For example, even in a rodef of murder, once I kill somebody, I cannot be executed summarily through vigilante justice. There would have to be a Beis Din of 23, which we don't have today. And same thing with a rodef. Once the rodef has done his nefarious deed, there would, of course, be no heter whatsoever to kill the rodef after the fact, unless it is to prevent further informing and the like. But preemptively, to prevent, the Shulchan Aruch classifies a rodef, classifies a moser as a rodef, and to add a little frosting to the cake, we finally are told, a moser is ein lo chelek liolam haba. He does not have a share in the world to come. So the moser is a very, very unsavory character, a tremendous sin, no share in Olam Haba. He is financially liable for all damages that are caused, and indeed he is treated as a rodef that might be summarily executed. Now, the question becomes the following question. We have Jews who are involved in all levels of law enforcement in secular societies. We have Jews who are prosecutors. We have Jews who are judges. We have Jews, all of us at one time or another, might be called upon to serve in a jury, which may involve convicting a Jewish defendant and sending a Jew to the authorities, so to speak. And the question becomes, how on earth can we reconcile, if we can, our participation in the criminal justice process, whether it's institutional, in terms of a role that we play, or whether it's in terms of just bringing information to the authorities with the very, very severe prohibitions against Mesira, which indeed are codified in the Shulchan Aruch as Ein Lo Chelek Liolam Haba, and a Moser is treated as a Rodef. And this is a very, very difficult situation, and of course we also have to recognize, on one hand, covering up wrongdoing might create tremendous Chilul Hashem, desecrating God's name. Of course, Chilul Hashem in some ways cuts both ways in this difficult area. Sometimes exposing wrongdoing creates Chilul Hashem, but in the long run, covering up wrongdoing may create greater Chilul Hashem when that wrongdoing eventually surfaces and people get the sense that Jewish people are covering up for each other, and it brings the Torah into tremendous disrepute. So what I want to do is I want to summarize three or four different approaches to the issue of Mesira in modern times. However, before I touch upon Mesira directly, I want to touch upon a related area that is technically not Mesira, but it often overlaps with Mesira. And that is the Isser d'Oraisa, which even many Orthodox Jews don't always keep, of litigating your disputes against a fellow Jew in secular courts. Now, this is not Mesira, technically, because Mesira would involve a criminal proceeding or turning someone into the IRS. But let's assume I just want to sue somebody for breach of contract. So I'm not turning him over to the government. I'm trying to collect money that is owed to me. So technically, that is not the Isser of Mesira. But there is an Isser called going to our kaos, going to the secular court system. And that is an Isser d'Oraisa. And Rashi in Parshas, it's based on the Pasuk, Ela ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. These are the civil laws that you shall place before the Jewish judges. And we have a drasha, lifnehem, in front of Jewish judges. And that doesn't mean a secular court judge who happens to be Jewish, but it means in front of a Jewish religious tribunal that is a based in, v'lo lifnei ovdei kochavim, and not in front of non-Jewish tribunals. And Rashi makes the point that even if, by some accident, the law that the non-Jewish court is going to apply would happen to be the same law as halacha, you still do not go to a non-Jewish court. One is mechuyev to go to a based in. And indeed, there's an Isser d'Oraisa to take a fellow Jew to a non-Jewish tribunal unless the fellow Jew refuses to go to a Beis Din, and under those circumstances the Beis Din will normally give permission to the person who's willing to go to Beis Din to take his case to a secular tribunal. So one needs to be cognizant that even if Mesira is not directly involved, because you are not turning somebody over to the government as it is in a criminal proceeding, there is still an Isser d'Oraisa of our kos. Now, it's a very, very tricky situation, because let me give you a very simple example without getting into all of the complications of our kos. Let's assume that I'm in an automobile accident, and the person who hit me was a fellow Jew. Now, usually, I will not be collecting from the Jew himself. Usually, I'll be collecting from his insurance company. His insurance company is a non-Jewish entity, and there are those that do permit litigation, although nominally against the Jew. They will permit it if, in fact, recovery is sought against the insurance company. So one needs to talk to a Rav or a Posek about these particular issues. But the Isser of Arkos is a very, very significant Isser, and it is considered to be a Chilul Hashem to take a fellow Jew outside of the system of the Beis Din. Now, people say, well, how can I go to Beis Din? Beis Din will issue an order and the guy's not going to listen. Well, keep in mind, if you go to a Beis Din, the parties will be asked to sign an arbitration agreement accepting the Beis Din as their arbitrators. Now, by signing that, that becomes a legally enforceable arbitration proceeding. And if a person does not carry out the Psak Beis Din, the other party can then go to secular courts and have the arbitration award confirmed, that's the term that is used, as a binding judgment, which can then be enforced. Suffice it to say, there is absolutely no halachic objection with going to a secular court to enforce the decision of a Beis Din. So consequently, by all means, a party should be encouraged to go to a Beis Din. Now, this pattern breaks down a little bit in the area of family law, because the secular law is that you cannot agree to arbitration of matters of child custody, visitation, and support, because those are matters that a court will reserve for itself. Now, that means religiously, in the case of a divorce, religiously, the parties are mechuyev, are obligated to submit custody and visitation decisions to a Beis Din, but there is no way to make it legally enforceable. Meaning, theoretically, if the other party doesn't like it and decides to go to court, there's not a lot that you can do other than the informal mechanisms of chayrim, and you know, which may or may not be work, or but there's nothing legally you can do to make that binding. But certainly commercial disputes can be, you can submit them to a beis din, and they can be absolutely binding. I have sat on batei din, which have rendered decisions in commercial matters involving millions of dollars. And they have been confirmed as binding arbitrations. And even though people sometimes raise the argument, well, how can a secular court enforce the decision of a beis din? Is it not a violation of the separation of church and state? But that's been regarded as a bogus argument because, like anything else, if I could name, you know, Chaim Yankel as my arbitrator, who cares what it is? Whatever the arbitrator decides is a binding arbitration. Let it be a religious body, let it not be a religious body. The court is simply confirming a decision of an arbitration panel. It makes no difference why the arbitration panel came to its decision. Now, this is a bit of a digression because, as I say, technically, our ka'os, which is the issur of going to non-Jewish courts, does not really involve mesira. For example, there's no statement in Chazal that says if you sue your fellow Jew in a secular court, you don't have a share in Olam Haba and you're a rode. It's bad, but you're not as bad as a moser. So it's not exactly the same thing, but nevertheless, obviously, utilization of the secular system is related to that. Of course, this raises another issue. Maybe we'll talk about it later, Barichas, and that is, well, if I'm a Jewish lawyer and I have a Jewish client who wants to sue another Jewish client, am I allowed as a Jewish lawyer to bring the lawsuit, or am I a facilitator causing my fellow Jew to transgress the Aveira of bringing a lawsuit against a fellow Jew in a secular court? Well, no, that's one of the reasons why I'm a law professor instead of a practicing lawyer. I don't have to confront these very, very difficult issues. But let's now turn to the direct question of Mesira, turning a Jew over to the secular authorities. There are a number of interesting positions here. We have, let me start off with the very strict position, actually, of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein, although operationally he may turn out to be lenient, but in theory he's very strict. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that whenever the punishment that a secular body would mete out, even for an offense that's prohibited under the Torah, is stricter and different than the offense that the Torah itself mandates for that, there is a prohibition of mesira. So he gives the example. Let's assume somebody's a ganav, somebody steals. Can I report a theft to the authorities if it's a Jewish person who I suspect may have stolen? Rav Moshe says there actually is an isser of mesira, and that is because it is very likely that for theft, for a felony, there will be some prison time. Now, the Torah says you're not allowed to steal, to be sure, but the Torah does not mandate imprisonment for theft. And consequently, the person will be getting a punishment that is shelo kedin. And if the person is going to get a punishment, or may get a punishment, of course, people may be acquitted, may be probation as well. But if a person may get a punishment that is in excess of the punishment that is mandated by the Torah, Rav Moshe says there is an iser mesira to turn that person in. Now that's a pretty strict standard, although even Rav Moshe will have a number of exceptions I'll get to in a moment. But according to Rav Moshe, the test of Mesira is not did the person do something wrong under the law of the Torah. The test is the possible punishment greater than that mandated by the law of the Torah. By the way, this itself is a very interesting topic, how the Torah really does not have imprisonment as a designated punishment for crime. And you can see that the Torah regards all monetary offenses, whether it's theft or vandalism or damages, the main point should be compensation and restitution to the victim with a fine. There is a fine, you know, if you steal, you pay double and the like. And that makes a lot more sense in many ways than perhaps warehousing people in which the victim doesn't get compensated. And if anything, the recidivism rate is so great in prisons that you might take a person who's committed one crime and he'll become a career criminal and everything else. And of course, keep in mind, I think we can't ignore the fact that when a person is sent to prison, there is a lot more that can unfortunately happen than simply serving time. There's rape, there's sodomy, There's all sorts of things that could happen. And therefore, the idea that a person may be punished not only connected the punishment system of the Torah, but a person might be punished even in excess of what the law of the United States says is his deserving punishment. All lends credence to the notion that there is a problem of Mesira. However, let me point out that even Rav Moshe, who has a fairly strict position on Mesira, has a number of situations where Mesira would in fact be not only permitted, but Mesira would be necessary. Example number one, where the purported victim of the Mesira in himself qualifies as a Rode. This is standing it on its face. We talked about the Moser as a Rode. But sometimes the person that the Moser is informing on is a person who halachically is a Rode. That is a danger to the community that we have to get rid of. The classic example, and a very important example in this day and age, is sexual and physical abuse of children. Now you sometimes hear in the Hasidic community that you're not allowed to turn these guys in because of an Isser of Mesira. Well, again, I'm not going to say that they're wrong, but certainly the mainstream, all the poskim that I've seen, have said it is exactly the opposite. A sexual predator, particularly of children, but also spousal abuse as well, is a rodef. They are a rodef, certainly, because they endanger lives. But even if it is merely sexual abuse, it is not physical abuse, that itself is considered to be a rodef. The halacha is very clear in the Mishnah that if one is running after a woman to rape her, even though he's not going to kill her, he is called a rodef, and he may be killed. So here you have to understand, therefore, that the concept of rodef cuts both ways. On one hand, halacha treats the moser as a rodef. But on the other hand, if the person he's informing against is treated as a rodef, then the moser, he shouldn't even call him a moser, he is doing a meritorious action. So it's one thing, Rav Moshe says, not to report a ganef. Whatever it is, we try to deal with the ganef, I'll take him to Beis Din. If he doesn't go to Beis Din, I can then sue him in secular court for restitution, but I don't call the police. Don't call the police for financial crimes, although I'll discuss other views. This is only Rav Moshe's view. But on the other hand, someone that is a sexual predator, someone who is actively involved in physical abuse and the like, there's absolutely no question that one is not only allowed, but it would even be a mitzvah to report. In fact, the poskim have dealt with a very, very difficult situation, and it really is a dilemma. What if, by reporting sexual abuse, the child is going to be removed from their parents, which may be necessary, but the child will be placed with a non-Jewish foster home, or maybe a non-religious foster home? Now that's a very, very painful situation in which a child might be removed from I wouldn't really call it frum, actually, but at least a Shomer Shabbos home, and placed in a place where there won't be kashrus, there won't be Shabbos. Now, obviously, the Jewish community must do whatever it can to try to ensure that there'll be a placement with a family that shares the appropriate religious values. But you know, if you had to make a Hobson's choice, if you had to make a choice between a rock and a hard place, we would choose the non-Jewish home and the non-religious home over leaving a child in a physically and emotionally dangerous environment. So I want to make the point that this is in spite of Rav Moshe's very strict definition of Mesira. In other words, Rav Moshe basically says, if the punishment is going to be worse than the Torah, there's an Isser of Mesira. But even Rav Moshe would concede that the Isser of Mesira will yield where the person upon whom we are informing is in fact a person that is a rodef. Now again, you have to be very, very careful here. To be a rodef, classically, you have to be a person that poses a present danger. For example, now again, I understand that there's a lot of debate, can sexual predators ever reform? And I'm not going to address the empirical aspects. But let's say, Lamashal, there's somebody who's not involved in that now. But 25 years ago, they did something really bad. And and it hasn't repeated, they're not involved with children anymore, etc. The granddaughter, you sometimes have this case with repressed memories, the granddaughter wants to talk about her grandfather. There, indeed, the issue of Mesira would come back. Now, I understand psychologically people want closure and there might be certain needs. that's an issue. But nevertheless, just to turn somebody in, according to Rav Moshe, I'll discuss other views, according to Rav Moshe, just to turn somebody in for what they did years ago would not be halachically justifiable, because remember the analysis. The heter and the chiv of turning somebody in is because they are a rodef, meaning they are endangering people, children or adults, if they've already done their damage and they're no longer in that process. Now again, I understand, how do you know, but let's just assume hypothetically that that's the situation. What's past is past. Just like you can't kill the rodef after the fact, or the moser after the fact, you can't turn in the predator after the fact, unless there is the continual danger of Radifa. Now, the Shulchan Aruch indicates that the concept of the person upon whom you're informing being a rodef can actually go beyond sexual abuse and physical abuse. And there is a concept called community endangerment. Now, this is much more tenuous, but it does say if the nature of these crimes are such that it may have severe negative repercussions on the Jewish community, then Mesira is permitted under the laws of the Shulchan Aruch. That's kind of a different type of rodef. That's called a communal rodef. That would involve, for example, severe institutional wrongdoing, which if it's not turned in might result in the yeshivos, let's say, losing financial. Now that's an expansion of the laws of rodef. That's not focusing so much on individuals being in danger, but rather the tzibor. Now, once again, you have to be very careful, because the Shulchan Aruch may have been referring to historical epics where, you know, this wrongdoing might result in the whole Jewish community getting killed or punished, or, in other words, collective punishment. You tend not to have that type of collective punishment today, but still, funding decisions are made. You know, Congress, state, and federal legislatures, and they might cut out programs. Again, it's a question. I'm not giving any psak. Needless to say, I'm not here to paskin. But the Shulchan Aruch does recognize that the concept of the victim being a rodef, victim, so to speak, goes beyond sexual predators and may even encompass the type of wrongdoing that will reflect as damage to the Jewish community. The example that the Shulchan Aruch himself gives, or the Ramah gives rather, the Ramah gives, is a counterfeiter. That if the Jews are passing counterfeit money around, you're allowed to inform, because that could have severe repercussions for the Jewish community. Now, Rav Moshe, so I've mentioned two kind of, so we have Rav Moshe's definition of Mesira, and then we have Heter of the real Rodef, and then Heter of the communal Rodef. Let me mention a third Heter that Rav Moshe has, which is difficult, but it's a hetcher. Rav Moshe says, if it's part of your job, you can do it. Now, the example that Rav Moshe deals with is the following. That sounds a little broader than it's meant to be. Rav Moshe says, let's say I'm a Jewish man, I'm a frum Jew, and I work for the IRS, and I'm an investigator for the IRS. And in the course of my investigation, I uncover wrongdoing. It might be an Orthodox Jew that I uncover. Am I allowed to report that wrongdoing? Or do I cover it up? Do I resign? Well, what is Halacha telling me to do here? And Rav Moshe says the following hetcher. Again, it's a difficult hetcher in many ways, because I think morally it's problematic. Rav Moshe says that if there is an official government position of an investigator, an auditor, whatever it is, and even if you would not fill the position, somebody else would fill the position. And the assumption is that somebody else, nobody's indispensable in this world, right? So probably whatever you uncover, somebody else would have uncovered anyway. So Rav Moshe says, your Mesira is not the cause of the damage, because presumably the damage of being caught would have occurred anyway. And therefore, my unlike a witness, see, if I'm a witness to wrongdoing, I might be the only witness. But if I'm an investigator, then I'm not indispensable, because another investigator could pursue the same leads. And therefore, Rav Moshe argues that even though there is some shaila, in fact, he then debates, once I have the job, he concludes, I am allowed to turn in the person, and in fact it would be a Chilul Hashem if I would say, well, I'm not reporting on Jews or whatever it would be. Now the only question Rav Moshe debates is, am I allowed to take a job that'll put me in that situation? And there too, he says you could, at least in America, because it is really, it is only a remote possibility that you'll get a Jew, etc. In other words, it's not like Israel, let's say, where every person you'll catch will be Jewish. But again, as I say, I actually have some difficulties with this psak, because it's kind of like saying, you can do bad things as long as the bad thing would get done anyway. If you're positing Mesir is a bad thing, if that's your supposition, it's a little hard to say, but it's okay because, you know, if you wouldn't do it, somebody else would do a bad thing. I mean, that's not logically a legitimation of evil, but this is Rav Moshe's psak. So we can summarize Rav Moshe's position this way. Rav Moshe does start off with a very strict prohibition of Mesira. And the test is, if the punishment is greater than the Torah would impose for the identical offense, it is forbidden to inform. But Rav Moshe would agree that there would be three major exceptions. Exception number one is where the victim of your Mesira is a rodef that is endangering the physical or psychological welfare of others by abuse, that's the classic example, sexual or physical. Number two, a much more amorphous idea, where the person's behavior is endangering the welfare of the Jewish community. So it's not just a private crime, but it's a crime that may have repercussions for Am Yisrael, or your local Jewish community. And number three, where it is part of your job, and the assumption is, you know, is that if you were to recuse yourself, the damage would occur anyway. And therefore, you're not increasing any detriment, because if you were to simply say no, somebody else would step in. This is Rav Moshe's position. And of course, positions in these matters have a tremendous, tremendous amount of weight. But I do want to share with you some other positions in Halacha that are even more liberal in the sense of recognizing Mesira as less of a prohibition today for a variety of reasons. And that is, there is a comment of the Aruch HaShulchan. Now the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Halevi Epstein, was a great, great Rav in the Vardik, in Russia, in the late 19th and very early part of the 20th century. And the Aruch HaShulchan is a restatement of the whole Shulchan Aruch. In fact, he even wrote other volumes called Aruch HaShulchan HaAsid, dealing with Zerayim and Tyros and the Beis HaMikdash and the like. It is said, I'll tell you a little joke, it is said that the Maskilim, the so-called enlightened ones who were kind of against traditional Judaism, were very hopeful that Sfarim would stop being written eventually and people would just concentrate on literature, general literature and culture, because they said the authors are going to run out of titles. And as soon as they run out of titles, there'll be no more Sfarim. So the story goes, when the Aruch HaShulchan was published, the Maskilim were very unhappy because now all they're going to do is reverse the titles and start again. Aruch HaShulchan, Shulchan Aruch. Right? So the Maskilim were not very happy with the Aruch HaShulchan. But the Aruch HaShulchan, which by the way came out, the volumes came out more or less concurrently with the Mishnah Berurah. They kind of overlapped. And there's a whole story that the Aruch HaShulchan has a famous psak that although under the law of the Gemara, you're not supposed to read Kriya Shema in front of a married woman whose hair is uncovered. The Aruch HaShulchan says, since Bisman Azeh, many married women do not cover their hair, he says, it's no longer sexually stimulating and you're allowed to read the Shema. This is the famous psak of the Aruch HaShulchan. And it is said that the Chafetz Chaim was so incensed over that psak that he never quoted the Aruch HaShulchan in the whole Mishnah Berurah. This is what the legend goes. Nevertheless, as a posek, I've heard it said that Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Elio Henkin both said that the Aruch HaShulchan is considered to be a more authoritative posek than even the Mishnah Berurah, because the Aruch HaShulchan was a communal Rav, and the Aruch HaShulchan was actively involved in day-to-day life for over 50 years in a way that the Chafetz Chaim was not. The Chafetz Chaim was a Rosh Hashiva and a Gadol b'Yisrael, but he was not actually running a particular community. So Rav Moshe actually follows the Aruch HaShulchan, not on the hair thing, but on the other matters, he follows the Aruch HaShulchan more than the Mishnah Berurah. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan says the following in Hilchos Mesira. This is in Choshen Mishpat, chapter 381. The Aruch HaShulchan has a footnote. And what this footnote means is a matter of controversy. All of the laws of Mesira that we are going to be discussing only applies to oppressive and unjust governments that do not follow a system of law, that are arbitrary, capricious, that break laws and practice banditry and extortion. But governments that are law-abiding, that have standards of equitable fairness and procedures to adjudicate guilt, such as His Majesty the Tsar of Russia, and as we have in England and in Europe, there is no prohibition of Mesira, because all you are doing is cooperating with legitimate, law-abiding governmental systems. Now, there is a whole discussion in Achronim if the Aruch HaShulchan meant what he said or not. As you know, you often will come across in Svarim, in Shulchan Aruch, in Rishonim even, little annotations that kind of say all of these harsh statements about Goyim and idolaters. You'll see some notes that say, this does not apply, of course, to our civilized non-Jews. Now, obviously, a lot of this was inspired by fear of the censor. Talk about Moser. The censors were Jews who in fact would be Moser and turn people in and the like. And there is a whole discussion whether the Aruch HaShulchan meant what he said or the Aruch HaShulchan was playing to the censor. However, I don't think that takes away the import of his remarks for the following reason. The reference to the Tsar of Russia being fair, I believe indeed, was because of the censor. So take that out, okay? But that doesn't change the theoretical point. The theoretical point is a valid point, and that is the Aruch HaShulchan and the Tzitz Eliezer, the great Gadol who just died very, very recently, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Tzatzal, brings the Aruch HaShulchan as definitive halacha, that he says the prohibition of Mesira does not apply to just governments that are not anti-Semitic and that have what is called procedural due process. Due process essentially means that they have a trial procedure that follows rules. It is regular, it is stable, and the like. And therefore, Mesira only applies to banditry. It applies to illegitimate governments. It applies to either anti-Semitic governments or despotic governments that do not follow procedural fairness. That's kind of an open-ended term. If any of you are lawyers, have legal education, know that the due process clause of the 14th Amendment obviously is still open to many, many interpretations, but it's a basic concept. In other words, it's something that halacha is basically saying, even if the Aruch HaShulchan's position and the Tzitz Eliezer's position is very different than Rav Moshe's. Rav Moshe, although he has many exceptions, says, if the punishment is different than the Torah, it's Mesira. The Aruch HaShulchan and the Tzitz Eliezer have a very different twist here. They say, even if the punishments are different, even if the penal consequences are not the same as the Torah, if the government as a whole is not overtly anti-Semitic, if the government as a whole follows what you might call procedural fairness, if the government as a whole does not discriminate against Jews in particular, then cooperation with the government in the enforcement of justice is not within the prohibition of Mesira. Now again, some say that whole thing, the Aruch HaShulchan whole thing, was a sop to the censor, and he didn't mean it. On the other hand, as I say, I think it's very, very plausible that the sop to the censor is the reference to the Tsar, but the point itself is a well-taken point. And actually, it was echoed much, much earlier, going all the way back to the 13th century by the Meiri, although some say even that was added by because of the censor. But the Meiri, who was a great Rishon, who lived in France in the 1300s, already articulated the idea that when you have non-Jewish societies that obey basic norms of procedural justice, there is no isser of Mesira that's involved. Now, whether that means you should inform, now that's still an open question. In many, many cases, that does create Chilul Hashem. Sometimes not reporting creates Chilul Hashem. That's a difficult question that needs to be weighed. But it's very, very clear that if we assume, now some of you might disagree with this assumption, but if we assume that the United States is more or less a procedurally fair society that whose system is not overtly anti-Semitic, it would appear that according to the Orach HaShulchan and according to the Tzitz Eliezer, Mesira would generally not be implicated, even if the punishment is going to be worse or greater than the Torah itself. Now, there's a very chashuv Sephardic Dayan in Yerushalayim, Rav Ezra Batzri, who actually he wrote a multi-volume treatise on Choshen Mishpat called Dinei Mamonos, and he says he very much disagrees with the Orach HaShulchan's Hanacha, because he says there is no such thing as a just criminal justice system. And his point very much is because of the imprisonment issue. I mean, the point that I echoed earlier. Meaning to say, even if a system is fair up to the point of sentencing, but, you know, what happens in prison is, you know, not really commensurate with a person's guilt. And therefore, Rav Batzri disputes the idea that any criminal justice system that involves imprisonment can ever be regarded as fair. And he also makes the point, which may resonate in this Patriot Act time, although he's writing from the perspective of Israel, he actually writes that even governments that are supposedly fair and equitable, when there are issues of national security, when push comes to shove, when they're really at a breaking point, they will often violate individual rights. And therefore, there is no assumption that people will be treated fairly in the system. So he may agree in theory that in just governments, there is no issue of Mesira, but in practice, he says, there's no such thing as a just criminal justice system, and therefore the issue of Mesira is going to remain intact. So these are kind of two basic views. We have Rav Moshe Feinstein's view, which does posit the issue of Mesira, and then we have the Tzitz Eliezer and the Orach HaShulchan that kind of take away the issue of Mesira when you deal with governments that are procedurally fair. Let me just mention that there is a third view here, which analytically is very, very closer to the Tzitz Eliezer. I skipped something. I wanted to mention a view that I saw from Rav Herschel Schechter. And, you know, he doesn't give a mucker for this. I don't know where he gets it from. But he makes the... And, of course, Rav Herschel Schechter is a very, very, very distinguished Talmud Chacham. And I don't know... But he doesn't give a mucker for this chiluk. He gives the following chiluk. He says, there is no Isser Mesira, even if the punishment is greater than the Torah's punishment, as long as the underlying behavior is a violation of the Torah. But if the underlying behavior is not a violation of the Torah, he says there's an Isser Mesira. So let me give you an example. So according to Rav Schechter, theft, since stealing is against the Torah, even though the punishment for stealing is not imprisonment, there would be no Isser of Mesira. Income tax evasion is against the Torah because of Dina de Malchusadina. We'll talk about that. Therefore, even if the punishment wouldn't be imprisonment, there's no Isser of Mesira. But let's say the government created some offense, maybe there aren't that many of these, that somehow is not forbidden at all under the law of the Torah. Let's say, for example, they said, well, the example that came to my mind, you might disagree with, you're not allowed to smoke. Now, of course, some might say, that's a debate, some might say smoking indeed is forbidden because of sakana, but let's assume just for purposes of argument, not allowed to smoke. And a person smokes. Now, the person is doing something that's not against the law of the Torah at all, so Rav Schechter says, then there would be Mesira. Now, I understand the difference. I'm not sure what the makar is, because according to Rav Moshe's paradigm, that would be usher, because, in other words, even if, like theft, even if it is usher, you can't do it if it's a bigger punishment. And like Rav Waldenberg and the Orach HaShulchan, as long as there's procedural fairness in the enforcement, it would be mutter, even if it's a new prohibition. So Rav Schechter is mechalek between a difference in punishment versus the nature of the offense. So I'm mentioning it just to be intellectually complete, but I actually have not found a clear makor for the distinction that he suggests, but it's something to keep in mind. Now, as I say, though, by and large, you're not going to find too many criminal statutes which penalize behavior that the Torah says is totally mutter. So you're not going to come up with it that much, but occasionally You will. Say again?
And that also don't fall under Dina
D'Malchusa. Well, that's right. That's the trick, because most of the time, it'll be Dina D'Malchusa. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's right.
That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. And that really brings me to so I've mentioned, I think, three positions. We've mentioned Rav Moshe's position, with the exceptions, which are very important. We've mentioned Rav Waldenberg and the Aruch HaShulchan. And they mentioned Rav Schechter, although I don't have a mucker for it. Let me mention a position of Rav Shmuel Vosner, who is one of the senior poskim of our generation, the Rav of Bnei Brak, for many, many years. And essentially, I would characterize this as really providing the analytical underpinnings of the Aruch HaShulchan of the Tzitz Eliezer. And actually, I think a much more technically lumdish way. And he says, you got to analyze Mesira in the context of Dina D'Malchusa Dina. And here's what he says. He connects the two concepts. Let's backtrack a little bit. We all know that there is a fundamental rule in halacha called Dina D'Malchusa Dina. Dina D'Malchusa Dina says, I as a Jew have a religious, halachically binding obligation to obey the laws of my government. Meaning, if I violate the laws of my government, state or federal or local, I am not only a secular lawbreaker, I am violating halacha. Now, a little bit of an aside. What exactly is the makor, mehechi tesi, dina d'malchusa dina, who says? So there are a few different makoros that the Rishonim give. The Gemara never says, this is a member of Shmuel. The Gemara never says why I got to obey. Now, if you're a cynic, you could say, well, because Shmuel knew that his head would be chopped off if he didn't teach the other way. And yet, this is a halachic principle. So the question is, what is the basis of it? The Ran in Nedarim, Maseches Nedarim, says it is essentially perhaps kind of a John Locke implied contract theory. Not quoting John Locke, but based on the idea that if you live in a country, you are tacitly accepting upon yourself as kind of the rental that you will abide by the rules, because otherwise the king can tell you to leave. By the way, it's very fascinating. Because of this, the Ran in Nedarim says that in Eretz Yisrael, there is no principle of Dina D'Malchusa Dina, because they can't tell you to leave. Right? That's the old saying. Home is where they can't kick you out. So the concept is, in Israel, they can't kick me out. So paradoxically, the Ran says at least, there's no Dina D'Malchusa in Israel. But in America, if I decide to stay in the United States of America, there is a tacit consent to obey the law. So according to the Ran, Dina D'Malchusa Dina is based on a contractual model, a kind of social contract model. That's what the Ran says. But Rashi, in Maseches Gittin, has a very, very interesting chiddush. It is a chiddush into what is the source of Dina D'Malchusa Dina. And he says, it lies in the Noahide code. We know that non-Jews have seven commandments. These are called the seven commandments of Noah. And the seventh commandment is a mitzvah called dinin, judgments. Now what is this mitzvah of dinin? There is a machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban. What is the mitzvah of dinin? The Rambam says the mitzvah of dinin is to simply establish a court system that will adjudicate and punish violations of the other six. In fact, the Rambam even learns that the reason the city of Shechem were massacred after Dina was raped by one guy, Shechem, so why is the whole city massacred? The Rambam says, because the whole city was guilty of violating the seventh Noahide law of setting up a court system, and under the Noahide law people can be executed, therefore they were executed. The Ramban argues on that, but nevertheless, there is a mitzvah to have a court system. Ramban says Dinan is much more. Nachmanides. Ramban says Dinin is a general command on non-Jewish societies to legislate and promulgate rules of appropriate social behavior. And those laws become binding under Dinin. Now, look what Rashi makes a jump here, which you might miss. Now, technically, that just means those are the seven commandments of Noah. Rashi says no. If non-Jewish societies are given halakhic authority to promulgate laws for the betterment of society, so again, I'm suggesting Rashi is following Ramban's definition of dinit, those laws become binding on Jews. Big chiddush. Rashi is taking the Noahide commandment of dinim and creating it as the halachic basis for the obligation of a Jew to keep that law. So Rashi says, the yesod of dina demalchusa dina is that if dinim gives non-Jewish governments the right and the obligation to promulgate law, that creates an obligation on the part of the Jew to obey that law. So based on Rashi, it turns out the following. Dina de Malchusa Dina will be defined by the legitimate scope of the Noahide provision al Hadina. In other words, whatever is within the legitimate scope of Bnei Noach, it's Tavo al-Adinim, will turn into my obligation because of Dina de Malchusa Dina. It is not based on social contract, although it may still be true, maybe in Eretz Israel it's not clear Bnei Noach would have jurisdiction. It's not based on social contract per se, it is based on an extension or an implication or a corollary of Bnei Noach. It's a very big chiddush. Rashi is going like the Ramban, but he's taking the Ramban one step further. There's a tshuva from the Chasam Sofer, by the way, that also says that the Rambam is also motive to the Ramban as well, except the Rambam would subsume offenses against the social order as either Gezel or Ritzicha. In other words, he's motive in principle to this legislative power, but he doesn't count it as dinim. He counts it as a subheading under some of the other ones. So the Chasam Sofer actually says there's no machlokas on this point. So, I mean, Rav Ozner doesn't go into all of this, but Rav Ozner basically says, therefore, that here is the point. If non-Jewish societies are empowered to make laws, number one, and number two, Jews are supposed to obey those laws, then number three, how could there be an issue of Mesira? How could I be doing something wrong if all I'm doing is facilitating the enforcement of a halachically valid law that Jewish people are supposed to keep? Now again, Chilul Hashem is still going to be relevant here. But other than Chilul Hashem, so Rav Ozner says very logically, when there's Dina de Malchusa Dina, there can be no Isser of Nisir. Now I would suggest that although the Aruch HaShulchan and the Tzitz Eliezer do not quite articulate it in that way, they just make the point, if it's a fair government, no problem, but I would suggest that Rav Ozner is actually the theoretical foundation of this, because if they can make a law that I have to obey, even if the punishments are different, then what is Reuven doing wrong by helping them enforce that law? Certainly if it's your job, there'd be no problem, and the like. So Rav Ozner therefore creates a very important linkage. Now I want to be sure that you understand what I'm saying. I'm not suggesting a Jew has to be a Moser because of Dina de Malchus Dina. In point of fact, that's normally not the case. Most of the time, unless you're actively obstructing justice, the government law does not obligate you to report. I'll discuss what happens if there is such an obligation. So I'm not saying I got a report because of Dina de Malchus Dina. Rather, it's a much more subtle point. Even if the government does not say I have to report and I'm not violating a law, but to help the government enforce the valid laws which Jews are obligated to keep under Dina de Malchus Dina is not Mesira by definition. That's a very, very... you might be surprised coming from Bnei Brak, you wouldn't necessarily expect that type of analysis. But nevertheless, it's a very, very powerful analysis in terms of understanding why just governments, because it's brought down in Halacha anyway, an unjust government, there's no Dina de Malchus Dina. So to connect the two concepts is a very, very cogent analysis. So the question then becomes, okay, so let's step back a little bit and ask ourselves, what exactly is the scope of Dina de Malchus Dina? The Rashba pointed out a long time ago that it's impossible to take the term at face value, that whatever the government decides, the government says civil divorces terminate marriages. Obviously not, although the reform movement has taken that position. You can't, if not in the United States, but you can't open your, that's the Sunday law, but you can't close your store on Shabbos, right? And obviously the Rosh Plus says, if you take it literally, the whole Torah goes down the tubes, which is not possible. So it has to have some type of demarcation. And there are different views. There are narrow views and there are broad views. The Shulchan Aruch itself does take a very, very narrow view. And perhaps that's based on the social contract theory of the Ran that says because they can kick you out, they can charge you rent. And the Shulchan Aruch basically says, Dina de Malchusa Dina is limited to the financial interests of the government involving taxation, non-counterfeiting of money, and the like. But if it simply does not involve the government's own interests, there's no Dina de Malchusa Dina. The Ramah, however, has a much broader definition. The Ramah's definition of Dina de Malchusa Dina is anything that is designed to promote the well-being of society. So, for example, according to the Ramah, minimum wage laws would be Dina de Malchusa Dina. Environmental conditions would be Dina de Malchusa Dina. Child labor laws. See, according to the Shulchan Aruch, that wouldn't necessarily be so. But the Ramah does say that if it's a toelis to the public. Now, even like the Ramah, keep in mind, it has to be a public benefit. Let me give you an example. The private rules of two people who make a contract generally should be governed by halacha. If I make a contract with you, unless we specify we want it to be governed by other norms, the government does not have a particular interest in how our contract should be enforced. There does have to be a public benefit. Nevertheless, in most criminal laws by definition, whether it's vandalism, environmental, or the like, are designed to protect the public. And the majority of poskim have indeed gone with the Ramah's definition of Dina de Malchusa Dina. And if we correlate it to Rav Vosner's approach, that when there is legitimate Dina de Malchusa Dina, there is no Isser of Mesira, so that itself would permit Mesira in many, many cases, even if the punishment is worse. As an aside, let me mention the flip side of this. We know that there's a mitzvah, a great, very great mitzvah, called Pidyon Shavuyin, to redeem captives. So the story goes that somebody went to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach because they were raising money to get somebody out of prison who was sentenced to prison for theft. And Rav Orbach said there was no mitzvah of Pidyon Shavuyin because the person was in jail rightfully. Now clearly this is not like Rav Moshe. Basically said if the person committed the crime and there was no anti-Semitism in the sentencing and there was procedural fairness, it was a legitimate prison sentence, and therefore he says there was no mitzvah of Pidyon Shavuyin. Now again, I'm not sure, in light of conditions in prisons, I'm not sure if Rav Auerbach was addressing that particular issue, and I don't want to get too political. If you think about Jonathan Pollard, where you certainly have, and that might be an example of anti-Semitism when you're dealing with extreme conditions that go... obviously I don't want to open up a whole hornet's nest, but all I'm saying is, one should not just accept as a blanket statement that anybody who's in jail, deserves to be in jail, and therefore there's no Pidyon Shavuyin. But at least Rav Auerbach's general point is, if there is a legitimate criminal sentence, he said there is no Isser of Pidyon Shavuyin. Now let me bring you a raya from the Rishonim to Rav Vosner's Yesod. And this is a Gemara in Bava Metzia on Pei Gimel, Amud Aleph. One of the great Tanoim, Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Shimon, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's son, had a job as a policeman. He was moonlighting, and he was advising the Roman authorities in how to know if somebody was a thief or not. And he was arresting Jewish thieves, and as if you're a student of the New Testament, you know that the punishment for theft was crucifixion. Maybe appropriate today. Okay? And the issue was this. Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha said to Elazar Rabbi Shimon, you are chometz ben yayin. You are vinegar, the son of wine. Your father was great wine, and you're vinegar. How dare you give over fellow Jews to the Romans, who would actually kill them because of theft? And the person said, well, this is my job, etc. Now, There's a whole question in the Rishonim, exactly. What's going on? What is Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon doing? So there's a tshuva of the Rashba that the Beis Yosef brought to the Torah, but this was censored. I'm not sure why it was censored. It actually is pro-government in a way, in which it says that since secular governments have the authority under the Noahide Code to promulgate criminal offenses against person and property, a Jew who assists in the enforcement of the Noahide Code is not a Moser and is doing nothing wrong. And even Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha, who calls him Chometz ben Yanyan, is simply saying a Talmud Chacham shouldn't get involved in that dirty business. Or perhaps, he says, or perhaps death was excessive. Death might be excessive. He gives two explanations. But Me'ikir Hadin, it was not usher. Even if Shulchan Aruch says Me'ikir Hadin, it's not usher, because it is a legitimate enforcement of B'nai Noach, Nitztavu al Hadinim. And again, the point I'm making is, if you learn the Gemara itself, you wouldn't necessarily know, because maybe the halach is like Rav Yeshua ben Karcha, but the Tshuva Sarashba says that even Rav Yeshua ben Karcha is not saying that it's Asur Me'ikir Hadin, but rather it's either Talmud Chacham shouldn't do it, or maybe there was death involved, or the like, which you're normally not going to have in a modern situation. So that Tshuva Sarashba, which the Ritva also says the same thing in the Shita Mikubetzes in Bava Metzia, is, I think, a very good source for Rav Elazar. In fact, he brings it himself in his tshuva to link up Dina de Malchus Adina with taking away the Isser of Mesira. Now, let me share with you, though, an interesting tshuva of the Chassam Sofer, which seems to go back to Rav Moshe's point, that when the punishment is greater than the Torah, there is an Isser of Mesira. And this is the Chassam Sofer's tshuva. He deals with an interesting problem. First of all, he deals with a technical matter. Are you allowed to bribe a non-Jewish judge? So the Chassam Sofer says you're not allowed to, because here is the rule. Since B'nai Noach are commanded to have a court system, and implicit in that is they're commanded to judge fairly, so when you bribe a non-Jewish judge, you are causing the non-Jewish judge to transgress his obligation. And that is itself a prohibition called Lifnei Iver Lo Sitein Michshol, right? In other words, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah makes it very clear, you cannot cause a non-Jew to violate one of the Noahide laws. When you bribe a non-Jewish judge, you're causing him to violate his obligation. But the Chassam Sofer says the following. Let's say a Jew was sentenced to death, or is going to be sentenced to death. And you bribe the judge, or you bribe whoever it is, the prison system, to get him off the hook. The Chassam Sofer says that is not prohibited because a non-Jewish court system does not have the halachic right to sentence a Jew to death. Because a Jew can be sentenced to death, the Chassam Sofer says, only if there were two witnesses, two kosher witnesses who saw, and only if they gave him warning, and only if there's a Sanhedrin of 23, which you don't have today. And therefore, by definition, the Chassam Sofer says, any sentence of death against a Jew is an illegitimate sentence, halachically. And consequently, when you bribe the judge to remove the sentence, you're not causing a miscarriage of justice, but rather you're causing the judge to do the right thing. Now, the Chassam Sofer is assuming conceptually, not like Rashi's assumption. Because Rashi's assumption is that the authority of B'nai Noach to promulgate justice gives them jurisdiction over Jews. The Chassam Sofer seems to be saying it is only a jurisdiction over their fellow Noachites, it is not jurisdiction over Jews, and that takes us back to Rav Moshe's point that the punishment is not a Torah punishment. So it is interesting. On one hand, Rav Vosner's linkage is very well supported in the text in Bava Metzia with Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon. On the other hand, the Chassam Sofer does assume something that is very akin to Rav Moshe's analysis, although Rav Moshe does not bring the Chassam Sofer directly. What's even more perplexing is that there's a tshuva from the Chassam Sofer's own Talmud, Rav Moshe Shik, who was one of the great Gedolim of Hungary, who seems to go the opposite way of his Rebbe, although he doesn't quote his Rebbe, maybe he didn't see the tshuva. Rav Moshe Schick's Shiloh involved a woman who was arrested for poisoning her husband, a Jewish woman. And the question is, should they be mishtadel to bribe the authorities? She had confessed. She confessed to the crime. And as you know, under Jewish law, confessions are not admissible for capital punishment. If a person says, I killed, we do not kill him. A person is not believed to make themselves a Rasha. As a little aside, Maimonides, the Rambam, gives a reason for that, which has resonance. The Rambam says, because many crazy people like to confess to crimes they didn't commit. Now, the police will tell you that whenever there's a spate of serial murders, there are always guys who call up and say, I did it. And the police don't even, I mean, maybe they should, but they don't even check it out. He always calls up, you know, for whatever reason. Maimonides, the Rambam actually says, Kama Meshugam like to confess. But the question was, she confessed, and there was other evidence as well, but it was not halachically kosher evidence. So Maharam Shik said, there is no mitzvah to get her out, because B'nai Noach have the koach to adjudicate offenses without all those rules of evidence. Now, it seems this is directly opposite the Chassam Sofer's position, and that seems to tie in with Rav Vajner. So again, you see that it's a complicated issue in which there's not a lot of consensus over this. Yeah.
But we sometimes kill or have killed people in extrajudicial, other methods to get them, even if they
Normal
kind.
Yes, it's all connected to that. Some would say, well, even a Jewish court could do that, and therefore, but even that's considered to be, some say, there's some evidence that that's considered to be giving a Jewish court the jurisdiction of a Noachite tribunal. In other words, it's all connected. Zavol Adinim is why a Jewish court could do it Shalok Adin. It's all connected to that. It's all connected to that notion of going beyond the parameters of the strict evidentiary system. Now, let me just mention one... I'm sorry. Either kippa or the Rambam says, makim v'onchin shalom en adin, even without kippa. In other words, without hasra, we can suspend hasra and the like. Let me just mention one other set of problems. There is a related problem to Mesira, although it's not exactly the same, but it is connected, and that is one of extradition, which is a complicated problem, and that is occasionally the Israeli courts have Jews who have sought refuge. Mayor Lansky was a good example. We have other people too. I mean, we had in my own community, there was a very, very tragic situation of a very troubled teenager, Jewish teenager, who basically he murdered somebody, and he went to Israel. He somehow got to Israel before he was able to be arrested. And the issue becomes one of extradition from Israel to Chutz La'aretz. And that, of course, involves on one level Mesira. On the other level, it also involves special rules regarding Eretz Yisrael. You know, the Torah itself says, by slaves, at least, that if a slave runs from Chutz La'aretz to Eretz Yisrael, there is an Iser to send the slave back to Chutz La'aretz. It's kind of like a fugitive slave law, like if you ran to the north, you were free. And yet, the Rambam does point out in the Mora Nevuchim that you see that when it comes to law enforcement, we don't like to have safe zones. Me'im mizbechi, the Rambam says in the Mora Nevuchim, me'im mizbechi tikechen olamos, that even if the murderer seeks refuge in the sanctuary, we don't protect him. And the Rambam makes the point. It's one hand, on one hand, we don't send the slave back to slavery. On the other hand, we don't want to harbor criminals either. So the fact that it's Eretz Yisrael is not going to be a magical panacea. But still, you do have to deal with the issue of Mesira. And as you might imagine, this was quite controversial. In an opinion involving a fellow Nakrash, I think his name was, he was a French who fled to Israel. Justice Menachem Alon, who's now retired, Menachem Alon he was a very religious man, he's a musmach of the yeshiva of Chevron, and he was kind of the religious halachic voice. There's always like one token, one or two token religious Jews on the Israeli Supreme Court. It's a very hard place to be, because essentially everybody dislikes you, because the Haredim don't like you, because what are you doing on the Israeli Supreme Court? And then secular don't like you, because what are you doing with halacha on the Israeli Supreme Court? So he kind of gets hit like the Kutzker Rebbe said, when you walk in the middle of the road, traffic hits you from both sides. But Menachem Alon actually wrote an opinion in which he supported extradition, and essentially he relied on this definition of mesira, in which you are simply participating with the secular societies in implementing Noahide law. But Rav Shaul Yisraeli, who was nifter a few years ago, a very great Rosh Hashiva, he took issue with this. He says he really didn't see the point, because he says the alternative to non-extradition could very well mean let him be tried in Israel. In other words, it's not an issue of harboring criminals, and it's not an issue of concealing injustice. It's simply an issue of, if you're able to try him in a Jewish court, shouldn't that be preferable? Because remember, all of the heterim of Mesira are presupposing an inability of the Jewish community to handle matters internally. We really can't handle sexual abuse, so we have to go outside. But Rav Shaul Yisraeli argues that to use that as an extradition, he felt that was not warranted at all, because the state of Israel was perfectly capable of handling the matter internally. And certainly he said that, the justice alone did say that he would urge there to allow the sentence to be served in Israel, meaning even if the trial is there, because the crime was committed there. Because again, technically, I think Rav Yisraeli was wrong, because jurisdictionally Israel could not try the crime. The law in Israel at the time, and I think it's still the law, is the state of Israel, probably true in the United States, cannot try a person for a crime they committed outside of the state of Israel at a time when they were not an Israeli citizen. I mean, if I commit a crime as an American citizen, and then I run to Israel, and I claim citizenship under the law of return, the Israeli court system does not have jurisdiction. And I think that's correct. And therefore, Rabbi Yisraeli was not aware of that. Now, theoretically, Israel could amend its law and change it, but until they change the law, the only way the person could be tried would be to go back to France. Yeah?
Halachically, we wouldn't have a problem with that. Halachically, if a person is a Jew, he's subject to the Torah.
That's correct.
So therefore, it's just because of technicality.
No, I understand that, but Rabbi Yisraeli's point that the Israeli courts, just as a practical matter, that the Israeli court system could try, and that was not an available option at that particular time. But I'm not sure what our time is.
A little over time.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, these are just, again, there's a lot more to talk about. I'll just end with one question just to think about, and that is, I indicated before that in most of the scenarios of Mesira do not involve compulsory reporting. However, there are certain industries where there is compulsory reporting. Well, physicians reporting child abuse, of course, is compulsory. But as I indicated, that's clearly not a problem, because reporting child abuse is mutter, even if you're not the physician that has a duty. So that's not a problem. But sometimes we have issues. Well, for example, let's assume that I'm caught as part of a criminal gang, and my gang consists of other Jews, and I'm offered a reduction in my sentence if I turn in some of the other folks. Or let's assume in the securities industry, if you are aware of insider trading under the SEC, you are obligated statutorily to report. So this gets us into a whole other issue, what you might call mesira under duress. Meaning to say, can the issur of mesira be modified if, you know, you will either suffer a sanction like a revocation of a license or the like? It raises a lot of problems, because once again, if indeed your life is threatened, then, you know, if I say, be moser, I'll kill you, you might be able to do that. But on the other hand, if it's simply an economic sanction, there's a very, very big machlokas in halacha if you are mechuyev to undergo the economic sanction before you're over on the issur of mesira. Now, in many cases, mesira has all these exceptions, as I indicated, and especially if it correlates to dina de malchus dina. But as a theoretical point, the issue of what type of duress would justify mesira is a very, very difficult issue. And even if your duress is serving imprisonment, which potentially is life-threatening, but Rav Batsri takes the position that just like you're not allowed to endanger someone else's life to save your own, you do not have the right to turn somebody else in So you'll get a reduction of sentence. He would not regard that as legitimate because you would be saving your life by endangering somebody else's. So that's a whole other issue that we need to discuss. Nevertheless, it seems that with Rav Vosner's analysis, which is very cogent and clear, the laws of Mesira normally do not pose a big problem. And really, it just reminds us all that as Jews, whose primary allegiance is to the Torah, there's no question, but the Torah itself wants us to be positive contributors to the maintenance of justice and stability and order in society, because a society without order is ultimately, like what does it say in Pirkei Avos? Hispalo b'shlomo shel malchus. We should always pray for the welfare of the malchus, shel mole mora'a, because if people would not have respect for the government, ish yesriyeu chayim bula'o, people would swallow each other up. And I remember, when the Chachamim said that, they were not talking about the United States of America. They were talking about an oppressive, despotic, even anti-Semitic government. I mean, the government of Rome. And even in that, they saw positive value to the maintenance of law and order. And kal v'chomer, in a society that does fundamentally give us many, many rights, we do have duties and responsibilities to uphold the law of the land and be active participants in the pursuit of justice. So thank you. I'll be happy to take your questions. Yes.
Okay, we've got 10 minutes for questions,
yes,
everyone.
Yes, that guy. Yes, sir.
Throughout your very learned discourse, and we immensely enjoyed it, you mentioned Chilul Hashem.
Yes.
And each time you mentioned Chilul Hashem, it was with a weight. There's certainly an Indian of Chilul Hashem.
Yes.
I'm thinking of a problem that's been pervasive in Chinuch in America for a long time. And that is the question of the teacher who was a sexual abuser becoming known to the authorities, to the Hanhala, and what to do with them in a particular situation, how to deal with it. We know stories, verified stories throughout the country.
Yes.
So it's a problem.
Yes.
And we have a case now in the papers in New York. With all of the corrupt that you mentioned, it's obvious that there's no question about it. There's a child abuser, a predator, a road ape, or whatever it is. We're going to go to turn this person in. However, many in our own community, the Torah community, have brought in the Chilul Hashem aspect as more than a passing aside, but as a ikar in this discussion, in terms of the Chilul Hashem to the community, when this is known, perhaps to the school, perhaps to the image of the school, perhaps to the fundraising for the school, or whatever. Many of us would argue, as you alluded to, that not turning the person in is the Chilul Hashem, absolutely.
Yeah.
But speak to that concept of Chilul Hashem as an important part of this Mesira discussion.
Yeah, well, first of all, as you point out, using Chilul Hashem to cover up and not take action is a totally, even from a totally selfish standpoint, is totally counterproductive. These institutions are shooting themselves in the foot, and they're doing really irreparable harm to their own mission. So the whole thing is stupid. I mean, to cover these things up is very, very foolish. But on the other hand, you know, sometimes you do have, not in these cases, Chilul Hashem, I think, has to be, you know, there are boundaries in the sense of the following. When you are dealing with the actual victimization of Jewish neshamos, your first absolute priority has to be to protect them. And if that causes Chilul Hashem, then so be it. That's what Hashem wants to do. Remember, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to make peace between a husband and a wife. If you recall the ritual of the Sota, God says, let my name be erased in the water. And I think, you know, how much more so to protect a child's life. God is mochel on his kavod. So to use some religious thing of Chilul Hashem to continue to allow kids to be victimized, I think is just totally wrong. On the other hand, if you're dealing with, which is not the cases you're talking about, with past behavior that's long gone, and should we talk about it, should we air it, do we publicize it, I think Chilul Hashem, you know, is relevant there about not digging up things that are not clear and present dangers. I think we do have to differentiate between ongoing problems and things that are long gone and they're not relevant anymore. For example, after somebody died, you know, we don't have to dredge up all that the person did. Now, there might be certain categories, maybe of financial irregularities, although those are obviously, we have to be honest, that in terms of correcting them, which you know, if we could, as long as we could be sure that we're going to be okay for the future, perhaps it's better not to publicize certain things. You have to look at the nature of the offense, its correctability, whether it's going to be ongoing or whether it's the past. All I want to say is that Chilul Hashem absolutely has to be subordinate to the welfare of Jewish children, because that's God's own priority system. So I totally disagree with any notion of keeping people in their position. Now, the other thing, though, that you have to keep in mind is not all allegations are always true. And, you know, we have to be very careful. It's a difficult, difficult situation. When allegations are made, what should the initial stance be? Should there be the notion of guilty until proven otherwise? You know, what type of due process is halachically fair in these types of situations? That's a hard question. Now, in some of the events you're alluding to, that apparently is not an issue anymore, because it's pretty well known. But at least in the preliminary stages, I think schools are dealing with agonizing problems. I mean, we're not supposed to just cut the bait and throw the Rebbe over the ship the first time allegations are made. Sometimes allegations are made by troubled people. On the other hand, sometimes allegations are true. So that is a real dilemma, and you know, we don't have a fully satisfactory process for that.
Yep. I'm a federal prison chaplain, Fort Dix, low and minimum. I've got a couple questions. Well, one's a small theoretical in that thing of in that concept of whether Adina Vachuz Adina applies to things in Jewish law, etc. Is there a comparative thing in Jewish law to insider trading? And a couple more practical questions. Sometimes I deal with inmates who end up doing time or more time because they're afraid to testify on people. So it's like, you know, like they're sitting there when they could have got a lesser sentence. And another question I have is, aside from the whole general Masera thing, I, as a law enforcement officer responsible for certain programs, if a Jewish inmate does something improper to me, saying something that doesn't follow the rules or does something that endangers the Jewish program, I have a right, in theory, to write a shot, although chaplains usually don't, but I have a right to institute punishment or bring him up on some kind of charges where he would get some restrictions. And is that me, as the Rav, enforcing my own little bed then on them, or is that also within the whole rubric of Masira?
Yeah. Well, let me take the questions in order. Your first question was, is there a halachic analog to insider trading? Yeah, it would be called Gnevas Das. Gnevas Das is when I engage in transactions by deliberately concealing information from you, leading you to believe a certain thing when that is not true. So that would be Gnevas Das, which is a prohibited form of deception. So I think that it does model a halachic violation. The second question, remind me again?
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly the very last issue I alluded to, and that is, can you give incriminating information against somebody in order to get a reduction of your own sentence? Big machlokas, again, Rav Batsri ruled that's absolutely forbidden because you can't endanger one person to save you. On the other hand, if one goes with Rav Wuzner's paradigm, that if the person you're testifying against committed a crime which society can legitimately prosecute, and you're truthful and honest, and not, you know, exaggerating what that person did, Rav Wuzner, I think, would allow that as legitimate. And the third issue is this. Let's say somebody breaks a rule. Now, it all depends. If they're breaking a technical rule, you know, I wouldn't get them in trouble for it. But if they're either threatening you, or if they are threatening, if their behavior could potentially threaten the welfare of the Jewish inmates and the Jewish programs, then they do fall within the category of communal rodeh. And remember, forget about all these achronim, going all the way back to the Ramah. The Ramah already states that people whose behavior creates a severe detriment to the Jewish community, there is no issur of Masira.
What about a verbal attack against me that normally, whether it's covered the Torah or my responsibility to see that, if I was in a principal in the school, I would give sanctions on this guy.
Yes.
If I'm the equivalent in a prison, can I give him sanctions for his...
Well, is the fear that this will undermine your position among the other inmates because people, it's public, people see the way he's behaving? In other words, I would say the following. If it's just a matter that, you know, you're offended, you're hurt. Mm-hmm. So I would think that the proper mida would be nelovim ve'enam olvim, meaning, take the shame. If, on the other hand, you feel it is undermining your ability to do your job, and as a result the other Jewish inmates would suffer, then that would be illegitimate. So, but I, if it's just a personal, I know that people's feelings, your feelings could be very severely hurt, but I would not report it just on that basis alone.
I have two quick related questions. One is, according to Rav Moshe's heter, someone who's doing their job, well, I guess, does Rav Moshe apply the heter to a journalist who may or may not be uniquely situated to dig up dirt in the Jewish community? And also, according to Rav Moshe, who, let's say, allows for reporting on a rodi, does the heter extend itself only to calling up the police and telling them what you know, or also just speaking to
them about what you know? Yeah, that's an excellent question. This brings us into the issue of revealing information beyond the parameters of law enforcement, which really now gets us into Lashon Hara, not necessarily Mesira, but the issue of Lashon Hara. And Rav Moshe does not address that issue itself. Basically, Lashon Hara is permitted and even encouraged if it is necessary to protect people from a dangerous, injurious situation. However, the question becomes, that normally is limited to those who need to know. And the issue that every journalist halakhically always faces is there a need for the general public, as it were, to be apprised or informed of wrongdoing if it could be handled properly through the authorities? So I would say it's very, very hard to be a religious journalist. It's one of the hardest professions to be because a journalist, by definition, is there to dig up stuff. But it would seem as a matter of halacha that the authorities should be approached first. Now, if it becomes apparent that they are not doing their job, they're unwilling, unable to pursue, then whistleblowing could be halachically legitimated under the permissible gedarim of Lashon Hara. But it cannot be the first response. I know that puts the journalist in a hard place. Yeah.
Very practical question. Seeing that we're officially out of time, as it were, will Rabbi Reinwood consent to answer any questions outside the scope? Is he have to leave?
Well, I can be here for a while. I have a 2 o'clock train.
I just saw someone official looking at his watch.
Let's see what time is. Okay. Okay. Yes.
But the Rebbeim on a base didn't may not be knowledgeable in financial law.
Yeah.
Taxation. So
it's a very good question. And keep in mind, there's an interesting point here, that even if you go to a base din, Dina de Malchusa Dina may obligate the base din to decide the secular law questions. And your question then becomes even a stronger question. They don't even know. They may not know that stuff. So, it is a problem. Now, I have recommended for a long time that, and many basins actually do this, that every basin should have legal advisors. They should have attorneys who are there to inform the basin in an impartial way. In other words, they're not just the individual attorneys of the litigants. What the secular law is, and the base then should be guided for that. They do need disinterested, objective inputs. And you are correct. It is indeed a problem. Now, to the credit of many, but they did, not all, many Rabbanim, if they're not familiar with these areas, will ask for this input on their own, meaning they understand that they need to be informed in that way. That I think it's a good idea to institutionalize that. You have a good point. Yes, sir.
If we're called to do jury duty service, and we find ourselves participating in a jury that defends the Jewish, are there any halachic issues that are concerning that?
Well, again, this ties in. Being a member of a jury is largely a form of mesira, at least potential mesira, because you're deciding about a person getting punished by the secular authorities. Like Rav Vosner, you would usually not have a problem. Like Rav Oldenburg, you would not have a problem. The problem is Rav Moshe, because the punishment might be more severe than the Torah. And the question then becomes, does this become your does this fall within the job exception? Now, this is very tricky. It's very tricky to figure that out. Because if you would not be a juror, there'd be another juror, but who says the other juror would come to the same conclusion? You know, it's a matter of discretion. But still, I think Rav Moshe would say the following. One of Rav Moshe's arguments about the job situation is, once you have a job, for you not to do it would be a chilul Hashem. That's what Rav Moshe says. So I think with a jury, it would be the same. Would be the same thing. That since jury duty is compulsory, it's not discretionary. Although you can get out. If you can get out, it's probably better to get out. But if you cannot get out, you are then permitted to do your job, even if that's a conviction of a Jewish person. Because once that is your job and you didn't have the option, so you can go ahead and carry it out. Yes?
Just to follow up on that, what if it was a capital crime that was being tried?
What if it's a?
Capital crime.
Well, it's much more problematical. Remember, according to the Chassam Sofer, it would not be allowed. According to the Maram Shik, it would be allowed. According to Rav Vosner, I think it would be allowed. So I'm not giving you a definitive halacha, but I do believe that we at least have some very great poskim that do allow you to participate in the even the capital conviction of a Jewish defendant. But it would be a disputed area.
Excuse me, according to Chassam Sofer, you would be saying that it would be forbidden to be a part of the jury?
I believe. Well, unless you acquit.
Yeah,
but you don't know ahead of time. Huh?
You have to pull yourself out. You couldn't be in it and then say, I'm going to paskin he's allowed to...
According to the Chassam Sofer, remember, the Chassam Sofer was dealing with bribery. The Chassam Sofer permits bribery to get the guy on. So it would appear to me, according to the Chassam Sofer, you ought to stay on the jury and vote for acquittal. That's what the Chassam Sofer, because that's the same as kind of bribery. As far as I understand. And if anything, there's less chilul Hashem, because voting for acquittal doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't have the same obvious wrongdoing as actually bribing. But that's what it appears, as strange as that sounds. Well, thank you very much. Enjoy talking to you.
I just wanted to make one or two brief announcements, if you could, just 1 second. As you are aware, there is no charge for these programs. Thank you very much for all the compliments. So we received a number of really positive feedback in terms of what you experienced here today. We've had some anonymous donors. I want to thank you very, very much. If anybody would like to underwrite future programs, please see me. That's number one. Number two, Volcano is a cooperative venture between Stern Hebrew High School and the Yeshiva University Center for the Jewish Future. The previous event which we had was over in the Armenian Synagogue, where Rav Schachter spoke, where Rav Breidowitz spoke today, for those who were not in the room. And our next lecture will be coming up, most likely be in the Cherry Hill community. So again, we're trying to take a show on the road. If anybody would like to volunteer or to help underwrite the program, we'd very much appreciate that. Speaking of underwriting the program, we have a fundraiser coming up. It's going to be in the Marion Tribute House, and that's going to be called the Marion Trio, and that's going to be taking place on Saturday, February the 3rd, Matzoy Shabbos. It's a mini concert taking place, and I have more information up here. But again, we want to thank you very, very much for all the positive remarks. Rabbi Wecker, did you want to...
Yeah, just one final thing, and I want to thank everyone for coming. And again, if you have not signed in, give us your address so that we can be in touch with and let you know about future Volcano events. Please do so on your way out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again to Rabbi Breidowitz. Thank you. I have one quick question for you on the Chassam Sofer. I hope you're talking about in terms of bribing.
Yes.
Is it possible to make a chiluk into a song that he would say that the non-Jewish court has no jurisdiction when it comes to a capital crime, but that perhaps it could have some jurisdiction when it comes to NASA, you know, some type of a financial? But you seem to say that it's possible that the non-Jewish court has no authority at all over Jews. I was wondering why it is that you came to some type of such a sleepy marshmallows
well,
there.
Well, the reason I assume that some sort of said that is that some sort of seems to say that since the punishment imposed, the capital crime,
right,
is not the punishment the Torah imposed.
Right.
Therefore, the court has no jurisdiction. So that would be equally true for a lot of these. Sounds like he's talking about a capital crime.
He's talking about a capital crime in particular, and I thought maybe because of the Homer, and there we know the Chavdim Gimel as opposed to a base in a Gimel, or whatever, whether or not that would be...
It's possible. But even then, the Maram Sheik apparently is...
Right, I understand. No, the rest I understand. I'm just curious about that particular set of emotional... All right. Yes, go ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let me take your cup, by the way, Alex. Okay. You want a refill?
Not by 10%.
Okay.
If you lived in a state...
So, Talon, 10 minutes.